KJZZ's original production, The Show, is supported by Banner Health, Arizona's largest nonprofit healthcare system. Last year, Banner reinvested more than $1.1 billion in community health and charity care. Banner Health, nonprofit for Arizona. BannerHealth.com/nonprofit4AZ.
Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, if you're sitting in traffic right now, you probably know traffic congestion in Phoenix is up, and we'll talk about why. And a YouTube journalist who's traveled the world turns his gaze on America. But first, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is supposed to help people during disasters like floods and fires. But a new report finds the Trump administration diverted FEMA staff at key times to do something very different, help ICE in immigration enforcement. The report was prepared by House Democrats led by Arizona Congressman Greg Stanton, and he is in our studios now to tell us more. Good morning, Congressman. Thanks
Good
for coming
morning.
In.
Good morning.
Okay, so how many FEMA employees are we talking about here that were diverted to work for DHS, for the Department of Homeland Security, on essentially immigration enforcement?
It is hundreds of FEMA employees, and that is on top of the fact that since Trump has gotten back into office, 5,000 FEMA employees have left the agency or been fired. So almost 30% of the workforce is gone. And then on top of that, hundreds are being diverted for non-FEMA actions.
And this was something that came to your attention via whistleblowers, right?
Yeah, thank God there are courageous whistleblowers inside of FEMA, people who are passionate about helping people on their worst day, people that are trained and ready to help people when there is a forest fire or a hurricane or a flood. They believe so passionately in emergency management, and they're pretty angry about the fact that ICE is coming in and taking those employees and utilizing those employees, the skills that they have to help you emergency management, like setting up emergency centers, you know, within 24 hours.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really important skill to have. They're taking those employees, and instead of using them for emergency management, they're using them to help plan and execute ICE raids around the country and to stand up some of these detention center, which is both wrong and illegal.
Right. So it sounds like they were playing a pretty key role in this kind of mass deportation campaign that we've seen playing out around the country. Could they have done this without these, you know, very many FEMA employees?
I think they could have done it, but they wouldn't have done it nearly as well, quote unquote, as they did. But, you know, you and I have talked offline that there is a law specifically banning this from happening. It's called the Post-Katrina Emergency Management Act. Because after Katrina, we learned that when employees aren't ready to go at a moment's notice, that delays response and that can cost lives.
Mm-hmm.
The law specifically says that these key FEMA employees are there in case of emergency of natural disaster. They are not to be moved for other purposes, despite how well-trained they are.
Mm-hmm.
I think a big part of the problem is that, you know, FEMA is lost in this massive bureaucracy inside of the Department of Homeland Security. So Kristi Noem, the former secretary, just didn't think twice about moving employees around because ICE raids were her highest priority, unfortunately.
Right.
But under the law, those employees should be prepared for an emergency at a moment's notice, not used for another purpose. So I believe that this has had a tremendous negative impact. There was a terrible flood in Texas in July of 2025. FEMA's response was horrific and totally unacceptable. In light of that, they could have been on the ground much sooner. And the fact that they were taking some of their most talented employees and using them for a non-FEMA purpose is immoral, it's wrong, and it's illegal.
Right. You mentioned that law that came post-Katrina, the disaster in New Orleans. I mean, the idea, right, is to try to keep emergency management and these sort of essential functions out of politics. Do you feel like this is doing the opposite?
It is doing the exact opposite. But it also is the fact that the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, thought that she had the authority just to move employees around, didn't really care about emergency management. Obviously, her main focus, and unfortunately the department's main focus, continues to be this mass deportation effort and these ICE raids. The American people don't don't believe in that, don't support that, but that is the still the high priority for this department. And so just to move people around without regard to what risk that would be to the American people. Mm-hmm. Look, this agency should be a standalone agency. We need to get back the employee numbers so that it can really fully respond to emergencies. If there were multiple natural disasters at the same time, we are not prepared right now in America mm-hmm. for a significant natural disaster. I pray that we don't have one. But if we do,
yeah.
or we have more than one in particular, we would not be in a position to adequately respond. That's unacceptable to the American people. The whole point of FEMA is Americans saying we want to support our fellow Americans. We don't care if you're in a red state or a blue state, but we need those employees highly trained and we need them ready to go at a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, has been undermined by Department of Homeland Security and the Trump administration.
So you're calling for FEMA to essentially be made an independent agency. Do you think it also needs to be bulked up in light of, I mean, we're seeing many more natural disasters now in light of climate change.
Bulked up. I mean, it just needs to get back to where it was. Mm. I mean, they have, as you know, when the Trump administration came in, they suggested that they wanted to completely eliminate FEMA and have states go it alone when they have a natural disaster. I couldn't, that's so un-American. Like, we want to support our fellow Americans when there's a natural disaster. We want to help them. And the most efficient way is to have the federal government be in charge of preparing for and responding to natural disasters. We need to get the employee numbers up to the levels that it was before Trump came back into office so that we are fully ready to respond to natural disasters. It could affect us here in Arizona.
Mm.
We know that forest fires can ravage communities, loss of life, loss of property, et cetera. And the Department of Homeland Security had a policy when Kristi Noem was there that any contract above $100,000 had to be personally signed off by her. That had disastrous results. After the Texas floods, people were calling in for help. They lost their homes. They had lost other property. They may have missing family members. They were calling the emergency call center asking for support. Because Kristi Noem had not authorized emergency call center support, those phone calls went unanswered in people's worst day. We owe our fellow Americans so much more. So we need to get the department fully funded, get the employee count up to where it is. Those highly trained employees should be brought back to the department. FEMA needs to be reimbursed for the time of those employees because that goes into the disaster fund that mm-hmm. helps us prepare for natural disasters. And FEMA should be an independent agency outside of the purview of the Department of Homeland Security with an administrator reporting directly to the president. Those are the reforms needed to support our fellow Americans yeah. in their time of need.
Last minute here for you before I let you go, Congressman. I want to ask you about something different, about the potential details coming down on the Colorado River deal and how states are going to share pretty significant cuts to that. It's looking like Arizona is going to take the brunt of those cuts in some ways. You've called this a failure of leadership from the federal government. How do you think it could impact Arizonans?
It's going to impact us in very negative ways. Look, the action, the direct order about what needs to happen is going to come down any day now. But we know what the outline is. Arizona has already offered up additional cuts. The lower basin has come up with a short-term plan. It appears that the Department of Interior is going to accept that plan. That's responsible leadership. I think that our governor, Katie Hobbs, has done a really good job on this most critical issue for the future of our state, battling, advocating for Arizona. But we keep offering more cuts. The upper basin ain't. And it is up to this administration to forth both sides to a fair compromise, shared sacrifice, just like the original agreement from 100 years ago, half the water for the upper basin, half the water for lower basin. Any future cuts should be also shared equally. But right now, it's only Arizona and the lower basin showing real leadership, offering up additional cuts to get us through the short-term period. But long-term, the upper basin needs to share equally in the pain. Otherwise, it could be a great disaster for our state.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Arizona Congressman Greg Stanton joining us. Thank you very much for coming in, Congressman. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
If it feels like you're spending more time sitting in traffic on valley roads and highways, you're right. We probably are. New data from the Texas A&M Transportation Institute finds the average Phoenix commuter spends 76 hours sitting in traffic in 2024. That's 13 hours more than the national average. Phoenix also ranked 11th among the top 101 American urban areas for total delay in 2024. To help explain why, my co-host Mark Brody spoke with Kartik Jha, research engineer at the Texas A&M Transportation Institute and one of the authors of the Urban Mobility Report. And they started with summarizing what the report found for the Phoenix area, because it seems like things are maybe getting more congested here than they've been in the past.
Yeah, you're right, Mark. And we have seen that. And that's what we've seen all over the nation. Like, travel congestion is coming back. Reliability is getting impacted because of construction projects coming back in and all that. So that's a nationwide trend. For Phoenix, what we have seen is that there is a slight worsening of congestion and traffic. I mean, not all of it is a bad indicator. I mean, if an area is growing in population as well as, you know, activity, economic activity, that is natural. So sometimes congestion can be seen as a, you know, a positive indicator. But I mean, if you tell that to someone who is stuck in traffic for a couple of hours daily or an hour daily and, a, you know, it ruins their day, that's not good news to them.
Did you see that there were shifting traffic patterns in the Phoenix area? Is it just more cars on the road? Like, what to what do you attribute this this increase in congestion?
Yeah, so we see a mix of things. Obviously, the total travel itself, which we measure as a metric called the vehicle miles traveled, VMT. So that has increased for Arizona as a whole, but Phoenix in particular for sure. The national average delay per auto commuter. So that's basically the delay that an average auto commuter all over the nation, it's a nationwide metric, that comes out to be 63 for year 2024. For Phoenix, that number is 76. So it's above the national average, which is to be expected because we divide areas all over the nation in four population categories. And Phoenix happens to be in the very large, which is the largest of our categories, the four categories. So Phoenix is above the national average, but the silver lining is it is still below the category average of the very large areas.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of those numbers. I'm curious about this total delay in Phoenix in 2024. You found more than 203 million hours, which is a 6% increase over the year before. Obviously, that is a large number for a large number of people, but it's still a really, really big number.
It is, yeah, and it has been growing. You can see, I mean, heading into the COVID pandemic, it was about 163 million hours in 2017. Heading into the COVID pandemic, it was about 170, 168 million hours, and now it is above 200 million hours. So it has been consistently increasing since COVID, and even the ranks. So absolute numbers is one thing, but then the relative ranks is another indicator of telling you how that area, a particular area, is doing compared to its peers in the same population bracket. And there we see that the rank was, for Phoenix, for example, the rank was 14 all over the nation. So that's a total delay rank. Was 14 for Phoenix. Now it has come up to 11. So it has kind of worsened in rankings.
Is it surprising at all that the numbers are going up to the extent they are, given that there's still a good number of people who are, you know, working remotely, working hybrid schedules where they're in the office a couple of days a week and not in the office a couple of days a week?
True. So assuming if we didn't have the kind of, you know, work flexibility or remote working, you know, opportunities that we have now. Although, I mean, it is changing. We see that on a monthly and a daily basis, how those things are still kind of in a flux. Although things have stabilized a little bit, what we see immediately after COVID was that, you know, Mondays and Fridays dropped quite a bit. Even Tuesdays were not bad. But now we see over the last couple of years in 2023 and 2024 data, what we see is basically the middle of the week, Tuesday through Thursday, it is actually carrying a lot of the traffic, not just in terms of number of cars, but also the delay. The delay is, for example, if I talk about Phoenix, it has changed quite a bit from 2019, heading right after the pandemic. So now we see that the middle of the week has actually quite a bit of, congestion, delay, a lot of cars. Friday still is closed, but it has dropped. And Mondays are definitely lower than what they used to be before.
Do the numbers you just cited, though, indicate that some large percentage of the congestion we're seeing in Phoenix is work commute related? It's not like a situation like in parts of LA or New York City where, like, no matter what time of day you get on the roads, you're going to be stuck in traffic. It sounds like what you're saying is in Phoenix anyway, it's still concentrated during the weekday, sort of during rush hour, people going to and from work.
That is true. Yeah, still. I mean, the commutes still kind of contribute to the majority of the delay. But then, especially for Phoenix, what I noticed was even the truck traffic contributes quite a bit of the delay. We talked about rankings for the total delay, which includes all vehicles. Actually, even the ranks for the truck delay for Phoenix have worsened. It was at rank 14 all over the nation for truck delay, total truck delay in 2017. Now it is at number 7. So that's quite a jump in relative rankings. So I'm suspecting that a lot of this delay is also being contributed by freight trucks. People order more, online deliveries, on Instacarts and online shopping, delivery at home and all that. That contributes to more truck traffic. Plus, the truck traffic now is also kind of peeking into the regular commute hours. We see some more, relatively speaking, some more truck traffic during those commute peak periods as well.
Do you believe that increased congestion is just sort of a fact of life in a growing city? Like, is there anything that Phoenix or any other city can be doing to try to mitigate this?
Absolutely. You're right. Bang on. Congestion is kind of a fact of life in thriving areas, especially in regions with strong economies and steady population growth. Frankly, in terms of policy making, you even want to see that sometimes because, it is an indicator of growth. But there are ways that agencies obviously use to counter that as much as possible, even though you will see growth in congestion and traffic, but you can reduce that pace of growth and pace of deterioration. So what opportunities agencies are seeing more now and now from now on is that, instead of just keep adding additional capacity, because the same traffic or a little higher traffic to in terms of number of cars is spread across the week and spread across the day, agencies, state agencies, MPOs, cities are looking at more and more TISMO. What we call TISMO is Transportation System Management and Operations. So basically, using the same system but more efficiently in terms of signal timing, auxiliary lanes for trucks. So any kind of variable message signs, dynamic speed messaging and all that. So people are trying to look at operational strategies in conjunction with adding capacity to make the best use of their funds in order for the existing system to be able to absorb more traffic demand.
Kartik Jha is a research engineer at the Texas A&M Transportation Institute and one of the authors of the Urban Mobility Report. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I am Lauren Gilger. Coming up, have you ever wondered what you would look like as a bug? We'll hear from the Phoenix-based artist behind the Bugifier. But first, childcare is notoriously expensive. The market value in our state for it is $10,764 a year. That's nearly as much as a year of in-state tuition at ASU. And aid for low-income families to pay for preschool is drying up. More than 13,000 kids are now on the Arizona Department of Economic Security's wait list, the Capital Times reports, a 575% jump since it was reinstated in 2024. And in Pima County, a scholarship program that sent hundreds of preschoolers to school is running out of funding. Becky Palick has the story for Arizona Luminary, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Becky. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us first about this program. The acronym for it is PEEPS, right?
Right, Pima Early Education Program, we call it PEEPS, and it is a scholarship program that helps low-income families cover the cost of a high-quality preschool.
All right, and this program is now seeing a long wait list of its own, more than 600 kids.
Yeah, the county said at the end of May there were already 630 preschool kids on wait lists for this program, and there could be more kids who need it. DES says there's 2,300 kids in Pima County that are on their wait list. So yeah, there's a lot of kids who need this program, and the county's not able to serve all of them.
Right. And so let's talk about what's behind that, funding cuts, et cetera. Like, as I mentioned at the top, and you just mentioned there, the Department of Economic Security has this massive and growing wait list for subsidies for early childhood education. And we're seeing other early childhood programs taking hits, right? Quality first, first things first, right? Outline some of that for us.
Right. First things first is funded by basically cigarette taxes, and with fewer people smoking and more people vaping, that funding pool is just drying up. So there are fewer scholarships available. At the same time, the number of licensed childcare providers is shrinking. So we've got kind of this perfect storm of revenue streams drying up. And like a childcare shortage in general, all happening at the same time.
And this is a program, right, Becky, that was built on pandemic relief funds, right? And those are gone for the most part as well.
That's right. So Pima County launched PEEPS as this really bold experiment in 2021, where they wanted to track this preschool cohort to show the benefits of early education. And it was built on one-time federal funds, which were those pandemic relief dollars. And that money lasted 4 years, but now in years five and six, different money is needed. So they're looking for different ways to keep this program going.
So let's talk about what those could be, because local officials there have tried to fill the gap. They've used override money in the past. What else are they looking at?
Right. It would cost millions to place all of the kids who are on the wait list. They're trying to decide what money they can come up with. And right now, officials in Pima County are considering other one-time monies. They just started talking about a possible tax through the library district. And right now, some library district funds are benefiting this preschool program. And they're also just talking about fundraising, like how can they raise charitable contributions from businesses and foundations to help preschool kids get into programs.
Right. You reported the city of Tucson dropped its funding for PEEP, so did Oro Valley. It's kind of left to the county here, it sounds like.
Right, the county is filling in gaps that otherwise would have been filled by our local cities and towns, and also by these state contributions. So they're really trying to figure out how they can put pieces together to make it work. And meanwhile, childcare costs are up almost 40% from before the pandemic, so families are paying more and getting on these wait lists.
The county also added a fee for some families who use this program. Is that right?
That's right. So some families are going to start paying on a sliding scale now. And these are low-income families, so some of the families will still be able to access these programs for free, but others will pay what they can, and that's going to help open up a few more seats over time in the PEEPS program.
But it sounds like in the end, the future of this program, which has been pretty impactful there, is still pretty unclear.
Right. So it's hard for families to find care that is quality and affordable right now. It's often the biggest expense in the family budget right after housing and utilities. And do you remember that game we used to play when we were kids, like musical chairs? It's kind of now the situation where there are two preschool seats and three kids who need to get in those spots. So it's kind of creating disparities in real time, and that's what we're trying to avoid here in Pima County by finding the funds to open up a number of scholarships for preschool kids.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Becky Palick with Arizona Luminaria joining us. Becky, thank you very much for coming on the show. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Pima County is looking for a new operator to run Old Tucson Studios. That's because the current one, Colorado-based American Heritage Railways, says it will not extend its current lease, which runs through April 2027. The facility is more than 300 acres, some of which is developed, some of which is not. Several hundred productions have been filmed there over the decades. To talk about the park's future, my co-host Mark Brody spoke with Diane Frisch, Director of Attractions and Tourism for Pima County, and they started with some of the options for what the county might do come next spring when the current lease ends.
Well, that's the thing. We're hearing some interesting pitches from people. Everybody loves Old Tucson. It's located in Tucson Mountain Park. There are some things that would be appropriate for that property. We'd love to retain the Western history of Old Tucson. Since 1939, it's been a filming site. We love that history and the filming opportunities. But there are also some opportunities to do some Sonoran Desert education, to build on how we might put together a new partner for Pima County. So it may be one leaseholder. It might be a collection of leaseholders. We're really just taking this time to think about it in a new way and what's best for the property and what's best for the residents and the tourists that come to Tucson to see it. At one time, Old Tucson was the number two attraction in the state of Arizona, right behind the Grand Canyon.
Huh. Is there still filming that goes on there?
There is. There is filming that goes on there, and a lot of people think it's just Westerns. But the site also has that beautiful Sonoran Desert background to us that is so, you know, fantastic. So we have documentaries, we have student films, we have portions of major films done. It's a variety of things. And we also shoot some catalogs out there. We shoot some photographs. People don't, you know, understand or realize that, oh, there are a lot of things that desert and those views are used for.
Is it possible that it could just become a county asset, that you wouldn't have some other enterprise that is a leaseholder here?
Well, we do own it. We own the property and the buildings. I think we always look at it as we like to have a partner and make it accessible to people. As selfish, we might say it's ours and we're going to just keep it for ourselves. If there are ways we can use it that will bring people to Tucson or Southern Arizona, if there are ways to use it for conservation and education for people, we certainly want to do that. So we're getting some interesting proposals and ideas. We haven't even opened it up. These are just people that are saying, oh my God, I love Old Tucson. I have an idea. And I'm talking to all of them.
Are you hearing ideas of things that maybe you hadn't thought about before?
Oh, yes. I'm hearing a lot of ideas. And there are some ideas, simply because of where it's located, that wouldn't be appropriate. Someone said that's an ideal location for a water park. I said, okay, no. A water park would not be appropriate in that location and the amount of water you would need. So we probably wouldn't do that. I've heard proposals for entertainment for a hotel or a casino. It's in the middle of Tucson Mountain Park. Again, there are some things we want it to mesh with what's in the area. So we won't be building a 16-story hotel. I don't think a water park would work. I don't think we appreciate and love that Dark Skies is also there. Mm-hmm. So there might be an opportunity for astronomy. Tucson is the city of gastronomy, the first in the nation. That could be an opportunity. We're hearing some very interesting things.
What is the financial component to this? Like, if you're going to build something, you know, some kind of observatory or restaurant or something like that, like, do you need to have an outside company come in to do that so the county is not on the hook for all that?
We don't need to, but I think we're looking at it as good partners are probably the best way to go. And some people may have experience in an area. I'd love to think that the county and attractions and tourism knows everything. I've found that if you have some good partners, that may be the way to go. Our end goal is really to make sure that we make the best decision for the property and people keep coming and using it. So we'll have to talk about financially what that would look like and how people would go about that. But we certainly are listening right now. We're in a listening phase.
Have you heard any ideas that you're thinking, that's a really good idea, we should do that?
I have.
Can you share what some of those are?
No, I can't. Thanks so much for asking.
Fair enough. You know, I had to ask. I kind of figured that
I
was
going to
be the
answer. I
knew you
were going to ask.
Yeah, I kind of had to ask.
You had to ask. No, there are some interesting things where we've said, huh, that could work. Let's think about that. And there are other ideas where people had come to us with partnerships where we've said, okay, that's interesting. Let me think about that. And then we'll look at it in terms of, is it appropriate for the property? What statutes or jurisdictional things do we have to think about? And then ultimately, the staff will take ideas to the Board of Supervisors in Pima County, and they'll give us input and direction and say, yes, that's something we think we want to move. And then we would move into a vetting phase.
Hmm. What to you is the importance of Old Tucson Studios to Tucson and Southern Arizona?
Oh, there's so many things. The importance to the community. I mean, the calls and the social media and the outpouring of people. We love Old Tucson. It's been here since 1939. They were destroyed when there was the fire in 1995. And it's part of our culture. It's part of our history. And moving forward, we think we'd love to be able to keep those things, plus add in educational elements. And everyone will bring to me pictures of them with their mom and dad and their grandma and grandpa out at Old Tucson. They just can't imagine it not being here. So I think there's a way we can come up with a plan and a partner or partners that we would respect all of that and continue on.
All right. That is Diane Frisch, Director of Attractions and Tourism for Pima County. Diane, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, Mark.
YouTuber Peter Santinello has traveled to 85 countries and lived in 5 of them. But for his first book, he turned his lens on his own country, the United States. In Your Fellow Americans, Dispatches from Across the Country We Call Home, Santinello goes to some of the country's lesser-known corners and documents the people we call neighbors. And he found a lot more unites us than divides us. He'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe next week, and I spoke with him recently more about the book and what he learned writing it.
We have such a massive country with so many cultures and ways of living and geographies. And, you know, doing the work that I do out in the country, you know, it didn't really hit home until I got out there. Mm-hmm. I'm at this full time. I'm constantly coming into new corners of the country, new culture, things I never knew existed. And this book just ties it all together.
You come at this from an interesting perspective as well, because you spent, you know, a lot of your life traveling the world, right? Like living in other countries. Mm-hmm. You went to, is it 85 countries really that you've been to in your life?
Yeah.
That's correct. Wild. So, I mean, you had that kind of very broad experience, international experience, and then sort of turned your eye to your own country. How do you decide mm-hmm. where to go in America?
It's just what interests me the most. What do people not know about? We can talk about Arizona because you're in Arizona.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of videos there. I love Arizona. But what do they not know so well? And that's what I dive into. So for an example, it might be, you know, what's it like, not from the outside of the Amish world, but actually getting in with Amish and, you know, getting into their lifestyles, or the Siberian Yupik people up in St. Lawrence Island who still hunt a whale. Mm-hmm. And are just as American as you and I, but living in a totally different world. They can actually see Russia from their island. Their island's 3 times the size of Maui.
Right.
So what are things that most Americans wouldn't think of?
Yeah.
And that's where I find myself.
Tell us about visiting the Navajo Nation, the Hopi Reservation. I think a great example of almost going to a different country, somewhat literally, in our own country, right?
100%. I've done a lot of Native videos. There are 576 federally recognized tribes in the country. And once you start digging in, like most things, it becomes more complicated and nuanced. And so, for example, Navajo Nation, the size of New Jersey, and let's say Cherokee in North Carolina, are two different universes. Yeah. It would be culture shock for each tribe to go to one another's. So they all have a different identity. I mean, there's a lot of feeling in these places, right? Mm-hmm. When I don't know if you've been to Navajo Nation, it's you detach a little bit from the country. In a way, it is a separate nation.
Is there something like a thread that you think ties together the places you've been? Because you've been also on ride-alongs in Yuma County. You went and did a mm-hmm. piece on Clarkdale and the kind of history of that place. Been in Glendale and the Valley here, looked at Arizonans off the grid. Like, what stands out to you about this place?
Well, Arizona is great for filming. The scenery is beautiful, right? Also, I'm pretty much guaranteed I'm going to get sun. But I'd say a thread that connects... It doesn't matter where in the country, but most people, most Americans are proud of where they're from. Hmm. They want to share their story. They're open. They let me in. You go in curious to any one of these places. Of course, some people want to have nothing to do, but the vast majority are very open. That's a beautiful thing about America. After traveling a lot of the world, people are open all over the world, but our culture does have an easy, hey, how are you doing? You say that to a stranger and then, hey, I'm good. What's going on? You know, that sort of casual talk where it's not like that everywhere.
That's interesting. So, I mean, you talk about this in the book, this idea that, I mean, we talk all the time in our politics and our government and our policy that we're like this incredibly divided country mm-hmm. and everyone, you know, is at odds. But you found something, it sounds like, very different in terms of not just people being open, but people feeling like we are all still united in some way.
100%. Nobody cares. I've never been asked once, who did you vote for? Hmm. And I could care less who somebody voted for, right? I look at them as an individual. Is this a good person I want to spend time with or not? And that's how most people look at their fellow Americans. I don't feel any deep hatred when you get on a personal level at all. But what I'm seeing, what I try to get in my channel and in this book, is there's the on-the-ground reality and there's the online reality. And most people are living in their bubbles. They're in their worlds. Doesn't matter where you live. I really don't step into politics much. That's not my angle. This is a place I want everyone to feel like, you know, they can watch my channel or read my book and get excited about it. And while most of media right now, I mean, it's just what's interesting, and it's usually trauma and dopamine driven stories. That's just the reality of how humans work. If nine stories are negative on America, here I'm offering one. You want a little break from the noise? Here, I'll show you a little break. And it's also both are true. There's problems. There's all sorts of conflict, but also the stories I'm showing are just as true. So I think it's good to break up the news cycle with something like I'm offering now.
Yeah, something a little positive. Last question for you, Peter. I mean, sure. So this is interesting, I think, to folks from the outside, because you're going to these places and so many places and talking to so many people. What kind of reactions do you get? Like, you walk up to somebody, are you filming? Do you say, hey, you know, will you talk to me about this thing? Or you just start conversations? How are you received around the country?
Yeah, that's the challenge of it. I'm received very well overwhelmingly. People are open and want to share their stories. Now, I always say, look, I'm making a YouTube video. Is it cool if I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. I would say 8 out of 10 are like, cool. Yeah, sure. No problem. 2 out of 10 are going to be like, no, I'm not interested. And of course, I respect that. So I always ask first. But that's why shooting in the United States is fantastic. Like you said, I've been to 85 countries, shot videos all over the world. People, they're open here. They want to speak. They want to share their stories if they feel you're coming in with good intention.
Yeah. All right. Peter Santinello, YouTuber, independent journalist, and author of the new book, Your Fellow Americans, Dispatches from Across the Country. Peter, thank you very much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. Take care.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I am Lauren Gilger. Our next guest this morning loves two things, art and bugs. And so she combined them into her career. Maddie French, a.k.a. The Bug Girl, just graduated from the University of Arizona with a degree in illustration and launched The Bugifier, a walk-up booth where she'll draw you on the spot as a bug. So we obviously had to try it out. So we invited Maddie to our studios to draw me. She came in dressed in a bug print dress, and that's where we begin our conversation.
Let's actually start with that. Tell us about your dress. What's on there?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. This dress is called like Worst Bugs Bug Dress. And it's just like literally every bug you could imagine under the sun. We got some centipedes on here. We got some beetles. We got some spiders, some like slug looking things. Like honestly, everything is on this dress.
And you wore it for your graduation?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so underneath the, you know, the gown, cap and gown was my bug dress.
It's awesome. So, okay, this whole bug girl thing is not just like a cute gimmick that you thought of to sell your art. Like this is deep for you. It sounds like you've always loved bugs. Tell us about it.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I was always that kid who was like lifting up rocks and like picking up roly polies and stuff. Me and my mom found out recently we were looking at some old pictures and we realized that my nursery was even bug themed. I mean, I had like there was like bug stamps on the wall. So, yeah, this is something that goes back since like probably infancy, honestly.
Apparently.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But at the same time, you've also always kind of wanted to be an artist, right? You've
always definitely. Been into that. That was always kind of like the thing that I would write down on the, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up as an artist?
And you recently graduated college with a degree in art, right?
Yes. Yes. I got my BFA in illustration from the University of Arizona. Just graduated in December.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. So talk about combining these two loves, this kind of lifelong love of bugs and, you know, the fact that you are an artist.
I think like I started really combining them in college. Like one of my very first drawing classes, which I was at Phoenix College, I did this still life of a beetle, and it was just like so fascinating and interesting to me. And like I feel like ever since that one project, I've just been drawing bugs for everything.
What do you love about them? Most people kind of don't like bugs, right?
I feel like that's kind of what I like about them. It's kind of fun that they're like an underdog, sort of, so to speak, you know?
You like them because no one likes them.
Yeah, exactly.
What's your favorite bug?
Ooh, I mean, I have a lot of favorite bugs. I always draw myself as a praying mantis, so gotta rep the praying mantis. My favorite type of mantis specifically is the iridescent bark mantis.
Ooh.
They're like sparkly and rainbow praying mantises. Like you gotta love that.
That's really cool. Yeah. Your final project even in college was of like bug girls, right?
Yeah. I did like a like blind box line of like these characters that were, yeah, they were bug girls. So we had like, you know, a cute bed bug girl. She was in PJs. There was a fly who was like a pilot. Kind of like Amelia Earhart-esque.
Okay.
You know? So, yeah, I thought it would be fun to kind of combine something, like you said, like kind of gross and scary you don't usually think of with like, oh, these cute girls, you know, in this weird way.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay, so talk about the Bugifier, because you've kind of turned this into something that you do on the spot as a real job here, right, at markets. Talk about how you came up with this.
So, yeah, I had been, you know, vending and selling art on and off. And after graduating, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing exactly, but I knew that I wanted to try to do some more markets. So I had applied to Scraps Market, which is this really cool event that goes on here in Phoenix that each booth has a sort of interactive element. And so since I didn't have something interactive, I was trying to think of like, okay, what is the most, you know, easy way that I could do something that is interactive? And I've seen like those live portrait booths, but I thought maybe I could do people as a bug, kind of similar to the like style that I had drawn those bug girls in for that final project.
Yeah.
And I honestly had no idea that it would be a success. I thought that people might think it was kind of weird and not really get it. Be like, what? Me as a bug? I don't understand. But much to my surprise, it seems to be very popular and people seem to like it.
That first market was like a big hit, right?
It was. It was. And it was super surprising to me. I definitely was not expecting it. That first market, I just had like a little cardboard, you know, booth that I had made really quickly, kind of a couple nights before. And yeah, it was a massive success. So it was super exciting to me.
Okay, so talk about how you do this. You're going to draw me. Okay,
yeah.
So let's do it. Let's see how you do this. You draw this on the spot.
Yeah.
You meet someone and you look at them and then mm-hmm. you decide what kind of bug they might be. How do you decide?
It's hard to say. It's really about a vibe. I mean, obviously, like, their outfit, the, you know, the way that they hold themselves. Like, this all has to do with how I decide what bug I choose to draw them as.
Okay, so what am I going to be?
Let's see here. I'm thinking maybe... Okay.
Okay.
I'll try your headphones.
Yeah. Any bugs that have a mic?
Okay.
Okay. What
I
is it?
I drew you as a green lace wing.
Oh, it's so cool. I have headphones and a mic, and yep. I'm wearing a blazer like yep. I am right now.
Yep. and some wings. Yep.
So appropriate. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Okay. So how do you do this? Like, when you look at someone, you're looking at vibe, like you said, yeah. to try to figure out what kind of bug they might be. But mm-hmm. like, how do you get someone's likeness down pretty quickly and in front of them? Like, this is not low pressure.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's part of the reason why I think I like doing the bug portraits as opposed to like a more accurate caricature, because, yeah. you know, I am drawing their face as a bug face. I don't need to worry so much about, like, is their nose the right shape? And, you know, bugs don't have noses. They don't really have the same mouths as us. There's a lot of less pressure. I mean, the main things that I am trying to get down is hair and outfit and sort of like general demeanor. And yeah. I think that that goes a long way in creating a likeness of someone rather than having to get any specific details done. Yeah.
Green lace wings obviously probably ask a lot of questions. You said you draw yourself as a mantis. Why?
I do. Yeah. I don't know. I really like mantises. They're my favorite. It just like made the most sense.
I want to talk about another project you came out with recently where you did a drawing of arthropods, right? For mm-hmm. for Trans Pride. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of you call it a riso print?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a specific type of printing process. The best way I can describe it is that it's similar to like traditional screen print, mm-hmm. but it is through a printer. So you're doing like one layer at a time. And it's super fun because the colors that you get with riso are just so vibrant. Like, you're not going to get those with a regular printer.
Sure.
So, yeah, I did like this design recently in pink and blue and white for Trans Pride. So it's different arthropods that have a unique sort of reproductive system, just, you know, to showcase that biology is weird and it's not always just as black and white as male and female.
Right.
There's a kind of all sorts of weird things that happen in the world. So humans can be weird too.
So I wonder, as you, it sounds like, can expand this idea of art and loving bugs all into one thing and in lots of new and cool ways. How far do you think you can take this? Do you want this to be your thing forever?
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, that's the goal, definitely, to just, you know, continue bugging.
Continue bugging. Lots to come for the bug girl. Maddie French, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it. Thank you for drawing me.
Thank you. So cool. Yeah, of course. Anytime.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.